friends. You're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. I'm delighted to welcome Michael Dowling. Michael Dowling, of course, many would know, is a leader of great renown. He has indeed a book called Leading Through a Pandemic. Michael is, friends, an immigrant from Ireland. And first of all, Michael, very welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's a privilege to be on with you, and I'm delighted. So thank you so much for the opportunity.
Mike, a pandemic, when most of us back in February and March, particularly leading up to the St. Patrick's Day parade, we didn't know that much about what a pandemic was, other than if we go back 100 years, we know and knew that indeed a pandemic back in 1918 wiped out millions of people throughout the world. And of course, you couldn't blame us from assuming that somewhere in the last century there would be a cure, as there has been for many diseases. And this was just one more hurdle to get over. How and when did you realize that that this, in fact, was something that there wasn't a cure for? As a matter of fact, with the exception of your own health system, there was very little known, and definitely little or no preparation for this horrific disease.
Well, we at Northwell, we realized in late January that there was a great possibility that this would hit the United States. Pandemics and viruses like the COVID, you know, they travel all over the world, especially given the transportation networks we have today, and especially in New York, where you have tens of thousands of people coming into Kennedy Airport, LaGuardia Airport, Newark Airport every day. And knowing what was going on in Wuhan in China and what was going on in Italy, it would be inconceivable if we did not see the effects of it here in New York, given the movement of people. So in late January, we realized that it was in all likelihood going to happen here. We began to plan for it. We didn't know how large it was going to be. We didn't know how fast it would happen. We didn't know an awful lot about the disease, but we knew that we had to get prepared for it. And so late January, all during February, within Northwell, we began to prepare. And we were fortunate because we had developed over the years a major emergency management infrastructure and a capability to deal with major disasters inside our health system. And, you know, we had to deal with 9/11, H1N1, SARS, Hurricane Irene, Hurricane Sandy, etc. So we had capacity and we had the talent here that was, we were in a better situation than most others. But we didn't get our first cases until the beginning of February. And then I remember on St. Patrick's Day, which you referenced earlier, on St. Patrick's Day, we had about 70 to 80 COVID patients in our hospitals, which, given our size, was not huge. But after St. Patrick's Day, not because of St. Patrick's Day, but after St. Patrick's Day, the numbers began to increase, and it really got bad at the beginning of April. And so by April 6th, we had in our hospitals about 3,500 very sick patients in our hospitals. And during the whole COVID experience here, and we still have some COVID patients, very, very few, but we've seen over 76,000 COVID patients in our health system, which is pretty extraordinary. I don't believe anybody else has ever seen that number. But to your question, we anticipated it in January. And, of course, the United States was not prepared. the administration in Washington was trying to deny it existed and trying to pretend that they knew nothing about it, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a continuation of that policy almost up to today. So they're still trying to minimize the effect of this, which is, in my view, pretty unconscionable.
Mike, your hospital system, one of the largest in the nation, comprises of 23 hospitals, 800 or more outpatient facilities, 73,000 employees. Now, how did you, knowing that this was upon us, what was your strategy in getting to your hospital workers that perhaps would have been as fearful as the rest of us with respect to what was expected from them?
Right. Well, the key issue here, and there's a lesson which is outlined in the book in some detail, is communication. So we communicated to all our employees very early on that we were preparing for the inevitability of a situation that could potentially get very, very bad. So we communicated continuously. We communicated in person. We communicated by mail. We communicated through our internet and websites. And our physicians communicated. So we just communicated 3 or 4 times a day to let people know that we're in healthcare. We have to deal with crisis all the time. We do deal with crisis all the time. And when something like this happens, we are at the epicenter of the delivery of how it is we take care of something like this. And this is why people were called, essential workers. And we were the core safety net essential workers in this regard. So our employees were made very well aware of it. Now, many of our employees got sick at the beginning because this COVID issue, in my view, has been around way before we identified the first case. I believe that COVID was out in the community as far back as January because we didn't know what it was at that point. But we had a lot of our employees sick at the beginning, and we resolved that over time by making sure every employee wore masks. And masks do work, by the way, for the public, masks do work. But it was constant communication, Adrian. I was walking the floors of every facility every day, talking to staff. And one of the things that is extraordinary about this experience is to see the commitment and the compassion and the courage of the staff on the front lines every day. It was pretty extraordinary what people did. But that's what healthcare workers do. Healthcare workers, in my view, are a special breed. They deal with trauma, they deal with disaster, they deal with crisis every day. This pandemic, of course, was the biggest we've ever seen, but the healthcare workers are able to respond when you communicate clearly. And it was done in every facility, every ambulatory facility, every outpatient facility, in every hospital. And we all act as one, so we've got single leadership here, single medical leadership across the health system, which made it easier for us to do this than other systems.
You know, many may not know that that Northwell Health actually services close to 2 million patients per year.
Right.
And to that degree, many probably would say, well, where is the manual? What kind of research was done? Was that widespread? Were there hospitals throughout the United States who had no preparation for this on the assumption that whatever about anything else, a pandemic was, out of the question?
Yeah. Well, there were many places that were unprepared, and many places around the country looked at what was happening in New York back then and unfortunately took the position, well, this is in New York, it won't happen here. This is a phenomenon that affects New York, and, there is a little bit of anti-New York bias around the United States, as you know well. And so some places said, well, it'll disappear, We had the pleasure of the United States basically saying publicly, this will disappear in the next couple of weeks. You know, we've only got some of the cases. And also, when the weather gets warm, it will disappear, all of that kind of nonsense. But there were people that were not prepared. And one of the lessons in the book that I make very, very clearly is that every hospital, every health system needs to develop an emergency management capability. They have to be prepared for disasters, and they have to prepare for themselves when things are going well. It's like the old story, you know, you fix the roof when the sun is shining. You don't try to fix the roof when there's a rainstorm out. And I think hopefully that's a lesson for every health system. And it's a lesson for the federal government, and it's a lesson for the state government. And I have to say on a state level, though, that the Governor Cuomo was exceptional here. I mean, I worked with him very, very closely, as you know. And he was exceptional in his leadership and his communication on a daily basis, which to me was extraordinary. So it's not only, one last point on this, it's not only healthcare organizations. Every business now has to be thinking about, and I know that they are because we're working with a lot of them, how do we prepare when and if there is another crisis, not necessarily a pandemic, but another major crisis. How do we actually prepare and anticipate how we should react when it occurs? In my view, the core ingredient of every organization is to be prepared in case there is a crisis, because we don't know when these things occur. And you should plan ahead, get your organization well equipped to deal with it, so that when they happen again, which they will, there will be other disasters. And the lesson here is, don't wait until it occurs. Plan ahead so you're prepared when it happens.
Having said that, Mike Dowling, there was reliance big time on getting the equipment, getting the PPE, getting what many would assume would be sitting in warehouses anyway, and reliance on the federal government to be prepared for that. So what did we learn, from that?
Well, two things. One is that given the fact that we know that these things are going to happen probably more frequently, given the growth of populations all over the world, and given the encroachment into habitats that's where feral animals and other predatory, creatures that can carry these viruses like this, that we have to be prepared. That's a lesson here. So the stockpiles, I think the federal stockpiles, the state stockpiles with equipment, we have to increase inventory dramatically. The other thing is that right now we should not be dependent in the future on other countries to supply us with the supplies that we need when you're fighting a war against the virus. We wouldn't depend upon other countries to provide us munitions if we were in a physical combat war. We develop our own manufacturing capabilities in the U.S. With regard to PPE and masks and gowns and gloves, we have to develop our own internal manufacturing capability now. So when these things happen again, we have the resources here. You are correct that during the crisis at the beginning, and we at Northwell were better equipped than most because of the infrastructure we have that I mentioned earlier. But the whole supply chain was disrupted because we depended upon China for most of our PPE. And all of a sudden, when China got disrupted, the supply chain got disrupted. And we were scrounging around, going to every country in the world to figure out how to find the proper supplies. You should never, ever be in that situation. And there has been warnings about this for years. Scientists have been talking about this. Epidemiologists have been talking about this for the last 20 years, that another pandemic was inevitable. But we as a country didn't get prepared. So the blame for this, goes over multiple administrations. It's not just only the current administration, it's multiple administrations. But hopefully now, if we're smart, we can sit back and say, it's not going to happen again. We have to be better prepared. The other thing I would say here, Adrian, is that right now we should be, which of course I doubt that we will do it with the current administration giving its philosophy, we should be engaged with China and with Europe, European Union, and with England and India. We shouldn't be engaged now in a global effort to figure out how to have an early warning system that we all agree on so that we can anticipate and know these things are coming. And we should have a global response. These are global issues that can't be solved only by companies, by countries nationally. It's global. And we should be leading that global effort. And unfortunately, I don't see it going to happen with the current administration, as I just said. But in the future, I hope that that's what occurs. It is ludicrous to think that we can kind of separate ourselves from the rest of the world on the situations like this. The world is unbelievably interconnected. We're interconnected digitally. We're interconnected information-wise. We're interconnected when you have global viruses. You can't separate from that. You can't separate from an interconnected world. And therefore, we should be taking a global leadership role here. And that's what the government, that's what the United States has done traditionally in difficult times. And it should be doing it again now. So every hospital system has got to be prepared. Every company has got to be prepared, and the states and the national government have got to be prepared. If we don't learn that lesson now, we are quite frankly quite foolish.
Mike, let's just talk about one. Again, I'd like to underline that you practice what you preach. There was a, and there has been a sense, and obviously at a business level, that hospitals and healthcare systems and networks, struggle at the best of times. And yes, there is competition. At what point did you say, wait a minute, ours is the largest system, healthcare system in the United States, but we need the cooperation of and we need all of the United States to know that we are in this together. Probably a hackneyed phrase at this stage of the game,
right.
But it was.
Right. Well, we realized then in early March that we obviously all needed to work together, and the person who was unbelievably forceful on this issue was Governor Andrew Cuomo. He talked to us, and he asked me and Ken Raske, who heads the association, the hospital association here in New York, to bring together all of the hospitals from the New York State, and of course the downstate area as well, so that we could coordinate our activities. And the governor, in fact, when we had our first meeting, the governor was on the phone. Remember, most of the stuff done all during this crisis was done remotely, because we had to go remote right away because a number of our senior leaderships got sick at the beginning. But all of this first remote meeting, which was done, virtually, was with all of the hospitals around the state. The governor was on the phone and basically said, we have to stop increasing our capability to add beds, increasing our supplies, working together to accommodate and deploy staff. So all during the crisis, we worked closely together. Now, not everything worked perfectly all the time, which never does. And we still, every week, the big health systems in the New York area, we communicate every week. We have formal discussions every Wednesday. Because now we are beginning to talk about, and we've been doing this for quite a while, what kind of plans do we have in place now in case the COVID issue raises its ugly face again in October, November, December, or maybe January and February. You know, there is a tendency for these viruses not to disappear easily, but to come back and hit you with a second wave. So we're all coordinating our efforts now to make sure that we're prepared and better prepared than we were the last time, and the assumption that it might come back. So, yes, we do compete. These big systems, we do compete, and I'm a big fan of competition. Competition makes you good. But in a time of crisis, we have to cooperate. And so we're, you know, it's interesting, we're competing and cooperating at the same time. And it works. And everybody knows that at the end of the day, healthcare has to collaborate for the benefit of securing the safety of the public and securing the safety of our employees, which is crucially important, because if you don't have, if your employees are not safe, then it's very, very hard to make sure that the community is safe.
You had to and decided to, you know, incorporate not only the New York health system in New York State, but you reached across the United States to bring in staff not familiar with New York or this part of the country, and that was something that, again, Governor Cuomo removed a tremendous amount of restrictions, and most of it understandable because of the threat of malpractice, which, again, would be a deterrent for anybody coming into the system.
Sure. I mean, the governor, you know, made a lot of accommodations by removing a lot of regulations, by granting immunity from lawsuits, et cetera, et cetera. And not only for people coming from outer states, but for people inside the state, because in an intensive care unit, we had to deploy multiple staff, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of staff, to intensive care units that never before worked in intensive care units so that they could help, because the deployment of the staff 24/7 round the clock was difficult. And it was very hard to get people to do that if they knew that they were not protected. And on your question about staff from out of state, and I made a call to Intermountain, which is the big, large health system in Utah. I called the CEO, who's a friend of mine, and I said to him, you know, could you in any way help, because we need staff. And he right away sent me about 65 to 70 employees. And others did the same thing. And I have relationships across the United States. And we have now developed these reciprocal relationships with about five or six systems across the United States. So whenever there is a crisis, they'll help us and we'll help them. Now, we reciprocated over the last couple of, over the last month or two, because I right now have staff out helping in Utah. I sent staff to Houston over the last month. I sent staff to Savannah, Georgia over the last month. And that's what we do. And when I sent a memo out to all my employees about who would be willing and able to be deployed nationally to help others, I had almost 700 employees say yes. So it is extraordinary that given the difficulty we have here, given the amount of time and effort these employees put in, you know, responding to COVID in New York, and given the fact that they had families and kids, et cetera, we still had about 700 of them willing to go to other states if that was necessary. You know, times of crisis bring out the best in people, as we all know. People's true character is displayed fully during a time of crisis. People do things that they wouldn't normally do, which is unfortunate, of course, on a day-to-day basis when things are calm. And this was a time in a pandemic when people needed to work together, and it happened. And I am very thankful for everybody that helped us. And we will help them, as we're doing right now, and we will help them again when that is necessary in the future.
The book is called It's Leading Through a Pandemic, and it's really the inside stories of humanity and innovation and lessons learned during this initial onslaught of the pandemic. It was written by you, and of course, Charles Kenny,
yes,
who is indeed the journalist for your healthcare system.
Right.
Now, reading through this book here, you hardly get a mention, which to some might say, well, wait a minute, when do we hear about Dowling, the leader of the pack, actually what you did was, and what the book does, is you personalize the contents of this book by taking and allowing, across your system, those who lived through it.
Right.
And there's very little about the fact that you, from day one, did not sit in your office dictating, what was happening, but rather walking through each and every hospital system, going straight into the fire, as it were.
Right.
To that end, was that something that you decided that rather than dictate or manage the system, that if you weren't prepared to do it yourself, then a lot of people would figure that you're...
Well, I spend, quite a lot of time with employees. I remember employees are the ones who do the work. Everybody from the security guard to the, cleaning person to the person in the laundry, the person who does the food, the nurse, the doc. These are the people who do the work. I am out in the facilities on an ongoing, regular basis. It's the way I like to operate. And in a crisis like this, it's very hard to ask the troops to give everything, and you'll be invisible. It's not me anyway. Then I was told by some doctors, it's a little dangerous for you to be out there on the floors in the COVID war, in the COVID units. And of course, almost every hospital, every single one of our hospitals was almost all COVID during that period of time. But I would not be happy sitting in my office. I had to be out there. I had to be with staff. I had to talk to staff. But it's part of what I do on a regular basis. You can't ask your troops to go into war and you decided you don't want to go in there with them. You've got to be with your troops. And some people say, well, is it dangerous? I never looked upon it that way. This is an obligation of leadership. You can hide during a crisis. You become visible during a crisis. You try to inspire during a crisis. You try to boost morale. You try to be optimistic. I mean, my message across all the time during all of this was, this is a tough thing that has just happened, but it's not what happens to you that matters. It's how you respond. And we are going to win this. We are going to beat this. We didn't know how long it was going to take, but however long it was going to take, at the end of the day, we were going to beat this thing. This is what the community needed to hear. This is what the employees needed to hear. And you need to talk to people personally. People put themselves in danger, and the courage and the compassion and the dedication was extraordinary. It's how I like to operate. And I'm sure other people do it differently. And I don't know if there's any perfect way, but, I was very involved. The book, I didn't think I needed to talk about my role in the book because, quite frankly, the people who did the work were the people I talked about in the book, which are the people on the front lines. Those are the people who did the work. I am very fortunate to be privileged enough to be the leader of the organization, but I fully, fully understand who the real heroes are, and they're the people on the front lines and the bedside. Doctors, nurses, and everybody else, respiratory therapists, social workers, you name it. These are the heroes. They were there every single day. And right now, look at where we are right now, given all that we went through. We're in a great situation in New York. But I would just caution everybody, including the people who are listening, that this is no time to get complacent. It's no time to sit back and say, we have won. This virus can come back and kick us. And everybody should wear a mask. Masks work. For people who are out there and decide not to wear a mask, that is, in my view, deplorable, because you're putting your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends, your community members, you're putting them in danger. Wear the mask. Social distance if you possibly can. Wash your hands on a regular basis. All of us have to play our part to beat this. It's just not only the person. Most people who got the virus never end up in a hospital, but 80% of the people who got COVID, they were treated at home or treated in an ambulatory location, which we did, But many can deal with it at home. So don't take risk. Do the right thing by helping your neighbors and your family members by wearing the mask and washing your hands and doing it continuously. And that would be my request to everybody who's listening.
Mark, darling, I just want to go to touch on a couple of areas where there was, a strong reaction from the public, starting perhaps with the initiative which you took in terms of we have to find every square inch of our system that can handle more beds. A great number of people said, wait a minute, you're going to stack beds in hospitals, and isn't that going to increase the chances of COVID taking over other patients in hospitals, pulling calling a halt to elective surgeries to those who felt the pandemic, well, that's one section anyway, they'll be all they'll be all right on their own. And of course the governor got plenty of slack for it as well. What was public opinion and how did that affect not just you, but say the employees, all 73,000?
Well, at the end of the day, many of our hospitals became completely COVID, but we stopped providing services and we shut down most of our surgery and we shut down many of our ambulatory outpatient sites. So the bulk of our basic business, 80% of our core business, we shut down, which, by the way, has an enormous economic impact. We shut that down because we wanted to make sure that we protected the public. And secondly, I needed to shut down those services because I needed the staff. I took the staff that were working and doing surgery in an outpatient facility, for example, and move them into the hospital because of the onslaught of the inpatients. When people came to the hospital, they were isolated. There was no contact. We made every conceivable protection that there was no contact between a COVID patient and a non-COVID patient, even though I would say at the beginning, we didn't know who was COVID or non-COVID at the beginning. Everybody that came to the hospital, we assumed was COVID. We did do some surgery during COVID. We did surgery on people that if we hadn't done it, it would have died of dire circumstances. So we didn't shut everything down, but we shut about 80% of it down. But when you were in the hospital as a staff person during the height of the COVID crisis, and as I walked the floors, pretty much everybody was COVID. Everybody was either there in a bed, they were there in the ICU, or they were on a vent. North Shore Hospital had at one point almost 800 COVID patients. Forest Hills in Queens was almost completely COVID. But everybody was masked. We had very little transmission of COVID among staff in the hospital after everybody was required to wear a mask. And we were the first to require that in the region. After when COVID, started to go away a month and a half ago, we now started to bring back all of the other business. And right now we're back pretty much 95% to where we were before COVID. We had about 35,000 surgeries that had been deferred. These are people that would normally have had some surgical intervention, and those surgeries were deferred. No life-threatening situations that we know of. Now we're trying to catch up to do all of that surgery. And so right now it's quite busy. And it's complicated because now as we bring patients back in, we've got to make sure that we control the visiting. We have unbelievable cleaning functions at every one of our facilities. Everybody is tested on the way in terms of looking for temperatures. Everybody has to get their temperature taken, both staff and patients and visitors. If when I go to the hospital now, which I do almost every day, as I walk in, my temperature is taken before I'm allowed through the doors. The other thing is we have the social distance. Waiting rooms are not used like they were before. In some cases, we have people waiting in their cars outside because we can't pack people into waiting rooms because we can't appropriately social distance. And anybody needing surgery right now, we have to test. And we are also fortunate, Adrian, as you know, because I outlined this in the book a little. We have the largest lab, testing lab in the United States run by health system. So we can do extraordinary numbers of tests every day. So we're well equipped in that regard. So it's a whole different world now as you bring the business back. During crisis, every hospital was pretty much COVID. And the last point I'll make on this is that we were able to move patients from location to location during COVID. So we moved out of Queens and out of our Queens hospitals almost on a daily basis, 50, 60 patients a day for a period of time, and we moved them to our other hospitals that were less affected by COVID. And we were able to distribute the load. We called it load balancing. We were able to distribute the load, which means that no one of our hospitals ever got completely overwhelmed.
I just want to address an issue that, of course, we're hearing more and more, and that is that a lot of people are really having difficulty in believing the results of the testing. And of course, now that it's a political football, there are those who say, I'm not going to go near it because half the time they're wrong anyway, and of course that's an exaggeration. But what is your view with respect to the great number of labs, that just appeared overnight, and the risk that, in fact, some of those labs are not equipped to give accurate readings? What's your view?
Well, we have to be careful. I mean, you know, there's no test that is 100% proof all the time. I mean, and we all know that. Just like even a vaccine, when it comes out, won't be 100%. Remember, we all have a vaccine for the flu, yet still quite a lot of people die from the flu every year. So there is nothing that's ever 100%. The danger right now is that we validate all the tests before. The test we use, we validate in our main lab that we're 95-98% sure that it is that legitimacy to the result of the test. But there are all of these, home devices that are coming up, and other quick businesses that begin, and the people say you can have this test at home, you can test yourself. That we have to be careful of. Some tests are 70% correct, others are 80% correct. So I would say that you go to a lab that is a legitimate lab that can tell you what the legitimacy of the test result is going to be. When we do quick tests, we can do a test, for example, that'll give you a result within 13 minutes. And then they'll give you a good sense that 80% of the time we can tell you that you're not affected. Then we take that test and we go to our regular lab and we verify it just to make sure. So again, I would just ask people to be cautious. Check out the history of the lab. Make sure you go to the right place. And be aware of the ones that just stopped up overnight, because they sound good, they sound sexy, but they may not necessarily be giving the results you need.
What would you say, Mike Darling, to those who would be reluctant to go to the emergency facilities of hospitals in general, those who normally would not hesitate in going to emergency, and now they say, I better hold off because of the pandemic.
No, I'd say right now we're almost, as I said, we're almost 100% back. Our emergency rooms are almost 80% back. I would say that, again, talk to your local physician. I would feel very comfortable going to any of the hospital's emergency departments. If you go there and you notice that they're not complying with some standards, et cetera, I would say be cautious in that regard. But for the most part, I believe that there is an extraordinary effort being put in about having the right protection protocols, the right cleaning, everybody wearing masks, the right appropriate social distancing when it's necessary, et cetera. So I would say, everybody trusted the healthcare workers and the healthcare organizations during the COVID crisis, and I would say you can trust now as well. It's always good to be cautious. But if you have something that you need to get done, I would say don't put off the necessary treatment just because of a fear factor. I think that can be overblown. It's not necessary anymore. And by the danger of not getting treatment for something is much, much worse than the slight possibility that something might happen if you go to a facility. I would say in our facilities, feel very, very comfortable, and I would say the same for Columbia Presbyterian, Sinai, NYU, et cetera. Yeah, you could feel very, very comfortable that the right thing is being done. We have the right protocols in place, and we're advertising to that effect as well, because we have to make sure that not only are employees safe, but the people come to us are safe. And I was in one of my hospitals last week, a couple of times, one of our big places, and at North Shore Hospital, and it's extraordinarily busy, people in and out of there all the time, and we're not seeing any infection transmission inside our facilities at all.
Mike Dowling, the book Leading Through a Pandemic, and it is indeed the inside story of the humanity and the innovation, and preparing for the future. And you mentioned complacency. I think a lot of people feel that the next time we have to worry about this probably will be October into the, into the springtime. So let's take a breather in the interim. How dangerous is that?
It's dangerous. If this comes back, we're assuming it will to some extent. We don't know how much. My personal view is it won't be anything like we had before. But again, we plan for the worst situations here. The key to it will be what the public does in the meantime, which goes back to what I said earlier. If you get together in a party and you have a block party, the younger people go to having a nice get together on a Saturday night, and everybody says, "Well, we don't need to wear a mask." That is very dangerous. Also, we will have to watch with school openings. We'll have to be interesting now, given the Labor Day weekend, when we had a beautiful weekend. It was gorgeous weather. Everybody is out and about. People are going to the beaches, and we'll see now over the next week or two as to whether or not there is going to be any uptick because of that. But inside the healthcare organization, inside hospitals and the physicians' offices, we work all the time to be prepared, and we follow the guidelines all the time. The public has to follow the guidelines that we talk to them about. If we do that, we minimize the possibility of having an uptick later. We minimize the possibility of having to shut down some businesses again. We don't want to be doing that. We want to be opening businesses. But public compliance by doing the right thing is now necessary. So if you know people that are out there and deciding, I don't think this is that serious, I don't have to wear a mask, I would just say to them, don't be foolish. Do the right thing. If you're not worried about yourself, at least be worried about your neighbors and the family members and others that you're close to. Be worried about them. And so if we get complacent and we relax, then we run the possibility of having an issue in the next couple of months, which none of us want. And, you know, and a vaccine, I mean, I don't believe we have a vaccine that can be distributed until next year. I know that there is political pressure to have a vaccine by election day. I think that is quite dangerous because politics should not dictate when we decide that we have a vaccine. So I think it'll take longer than that. In the meantime, the public has to comply with what makes sense. And it's a little bit, interrupts your normal routine. Yes, so be it. A pandemic really interrupts your routine. Wearing a mask doesn't interrupt it that much. You can handle it.
Mike, darling, again, thank you for joining us. And the book is Leading Through a Pandemic. Michael Dowling, my guest, together with Charles Kenny, who co-wrote the book. It's available, friends. We'll start off by saying that it has it's been published by Skyhorse Press, but Amazon, just about any place where you get books, this is the way to be. The audio version and Kindle and all of the stuff that people are very used to at this stage of the game, a constant question is, all right, we know about the book, but what about when can we expect this in audio version? Or
we haven't done that yet, and we've talked about it, but we haven't done that yet. I don't have a time on that. It's a very, very good question, and I am going to have another discussion about that right after we get off this call. That is absolutely a very good point.
Mike Dowling, again, thank you. Thank you very much for giving us the time and not only the advice, but also making us understand quite well not only what has happened and what the benefit of the learning curve, but also to let us know that something as simple as wearing a mask and being cognizant of not just yourself, but again, of everybody around you, that is something that's not going to go by the wayside. And if it does, we can expect the worst. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adrian. I really enjoy giving me the opportunity here. I thank you so much. And best to everybody that is listening. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike Darling.
Thanks. Bye-bye.